Thanks for joining us for this weekly joint meeting of the Mayor and Denver City Council. Follow along as the Mayor and City Council members hear updates from city agencies and projects, discuss important city matters, and hear about what's happening across the Mile High City. Join the discussion with your elected officials starting now.
Council, thank you so much for being here. We do have one item on our general session today. Thank you for Chief Thomas to being here to talk about education-based development, and do want to open with introductions and announcements. So I will start with the distinguished gentleman to my right.
Paul Cashman, South Denver District 6.
Good morning, everybody. Sarana Gonzalez-Gutierrez, one of your council members at large.
Good morning, Kevin Flynn, Southwest Denver's District 2.
Laura Alvidres with Lucky District 7.
Jamie Torres, West Denver District 3.
Good morning, Amanda Sandoval, Northwest Denver District 1.
Great. We will open with announcements. If there are any announcements that members want to share with colleagues or with members of the public who are listening at home, Councilman Alvidres.
Thank you for joining me on Thursday at 10:15 a.m. We will have a groundbreaking for a very important bridge that District 7 residents have been excited about for a long time, the Jewel Pedestrian Bridge. That will be 10 a.m. on Thursday.
Thank you.
Thank you. Others?
I'm really excited about that.
Okay, I think people are excited to hear from the chief. I just do want to say a couple words that were assembled. Obviously, these 2 days are hard days in the life of the city. We're in the midst of talking to employees about layoffs. That is never an easy conversation. I do want to thank all of the department heads who have worked so hard. One of the things I think you'll notice is that due to the really difficult work we've done to try to control growth in the budget over the last year and a half, it means that we were able to do about 80% of the reductions yesterday on vacancies and not on filled positions with employees in them. So our 171 folks that we'll be notifying is a little more than 1.5% of the city workforce, but importantly, in a city where 70% of our budget is personnel, that would mean that up to $140 million or so of that gap would have had to been solved on the balance of city employees. We're very happy that that is not what we needed to do or chose to do. Instead, we're able to close about $100 million of that gap, where more than 80% of that is from vacant positions. And so I know that will not make everyone's work easier, but it does protect as many of those city employees as we can. And so in the midst of these hard conversations, just wanted to thank the departments who are working so hard to do everything they can to both deliver core city services, to focus on citywide priorities, and to protect city employees all at the same time. With that, I want to turn to a topic that I know is important to many members of the council, to us, to the chief, which is the police department's work on education-based development. So chief, I will give this to you to walk us through the briefing on this concept.
Well, thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Council President, and members of Council. I know that I've met with many of you to give you kind of your own individual briefing. You may have questions that have arisen since then. Hopefully, they will be answered in the presentation, but if not, happy to answer any questions at the end. First, I'd just like to begin by right-setting some misinformation that I think is out there relative to education-based development. The current discipline matrix model remains intact. There have been no changes. There's continued full transparency with the Office of the Independent Monitor. All cases will be entered and tracked in a shared database. The Office of the Independent Monitor, I'm glad that Director Castle is here. I think she would agree that we are strong partners, that her office are very important in maintaining credibility and public trust. Every case will be thoroughly investigated to the satisfaction of the Office of the Independent Monitor, and there will be no shortcuts. Every case accepted for education-based development will be tracked, and there will be no second chances. So all repeat offenses or identified patterns of conduct will follow the normal process. And previous education-based discipline would cancel out any mitigating factor for a subsequent violation that might otherwise be considered. Next slide. I'm sorry. Next slide after that. Sorry. Education-based development does not eliminate accountability or oversight. So one, the matrix is a framework for determining appropriate discipline categories. That has not changed, and there's been no attempt to change it. The investigative piece is continuing at the internal affairs level, and the Office of the Independent Monitor will be routed the completed case to verify thoroughness. Then we'll have an opportunity to provide recommendations on education-based development appropriateness. Again, this is not a freebie for officers. Education-based development will cancel mitigating factors for subsequent violations because they were trained previously and didn't follow that training, so officers won't get that opportunity again. And I think it's important to note that of the 127 violations that are specific violations that can be charged to an officer, 66 of them, so 52%, are ineligible for consideration. These include specifications tied to force complaints, bias allegations, and EEO violations.
What's the last one, you said force, bias, and the third one was?
EEO violations. So those are like employment issues, so equal employment, yes.
Thank you.
So let's talk about current research. So organizations such as IACP, PERF, and the Department of Justice don't often endorse law enforcement programs, likely due to a lack of their own research, not because they don't believe in it. These entities also don't endorse active bystandership in law enforcement. I think you're aware that Denver has been a leader
an active bystandership in law enforcement. I discovered the program. It's active in a number of other departments across the country. Once I was introduced to it, I thought that it was valuable. A way to support intervention, and so I brought it to Denver and felt so strongly about it that that we organized a statewide consortium so that departments across the state could begin training and be able trained agencies. And just as bystandership is a science-based fundamental of active bystandership in law enforcement, training and development are science-based fundamentals of education-based development to create behavior change. Additionally, here's some direct quotes from the IACP and the National Institute of Justice relative to the best solutions for addressing performance issues. So from the IACP, education officers, the best solution for police misconduct through education standards and continual focused training, police misconduct can be reduced. Also from IACP, generally law enforcement leadership should primarily respond to performance issues with a training and development approach and resort to formal discipline only when performance issues become chronic, resistant to training, and or deliberate. And then from the National Institute of Justice in Harvard, the primary focus of discipline should be on changing unacceptable behavior. So, keep it up. So here's just a quick overview of the concept I'm presenting, recognizing the limitations of punitive-only systems and the advantages of behavior change programs that emphasize accountability, coaching, and skill development. Now some comparisons for traditional punishment versus behavior change. I think it's important to point out that accountability is not synonymous with punishment. Traditional punitive measures may create compliance out of fear, but can ignore the underlying causes of mistakes or misconduct, failing to change future behaviors. Education-based development aims to improve outcomes and reduce recidivism by confronting issues, requiring reflection, and building skills to prevent reoccurrence, which arguably is a deeper form of accountability. Education-based development factors in timeliness of the process, not just training, to improve outcomes. I believe this will also improve satisfaction with the process. Complainants will have a solution-based outcome, which is incident-specific training versus just receiving a letter of the outcome of the case. These are quotes from an executive session. Next slide. These are quotes from an executive session on policing and public safety put on by the National Institute of Justice and Harvard, suggesting alternatives for rule violations that lead to behavior change are often seldom part of sanctions imposed on officers. And equally as important, the impact of discipline on officers and the messages to both the department and the community are compromised the longer the time lapse from incident to resolution. Now, next slide. Thank you. Here is our concept statement for education-based development. With key points and one back. Sorry. I feel like one back. There we go. So the key points being officers benefit from timely, specific feedback and training. Education-based development supports the Denver Police Department's commitment to being a learning culture and public transparency. Education-based development provides overall better outcomes on low-level cases. Currently, 60 or more departments of varying sizes, to include 10 or more major cities in the U.S. and Canada, have developed some element of education-based development. These departments have varying uses of education-based development, some that we clearly thought were overbroad or just wouldn't work in Denver. And for these reasons, I have not only developed a model that fits for Denver, but have contracted with an evaluator to measure the effectiveness to determine if and where we may need to change or change course or improve. So what are the benefits of education-based development? Through the implementation of education-based development, I am proposing an opportunity to train behavior change. I'm also proposing an opportunity to provide officers more direct training for minor mistakes, improve outcomes for complainants, and better focus our resources on significant incidents of misconduct. Education-based development is not intended to replace the formal discipline in cases of egregious or willful misconduct, which may be more easily detected through repeated violations even after education-based interventions have been applied. It is designed for cases where learning and behavioral improvement are the appropriate outcomes. And I feel a tiered approach, reserving punitive action for serious breaches, strengthens legitimacy and speed of the existing accountability systems. Next slide. Okay. So here is our current disciplinary process. So as you see, complaints are received either directly to DPD or through the Office of the Independent Monitor. The investigation takes place. Then it is sent to the monitor's office for them to determine whether or not it's a thorough and complete investigation. And if not, then things that we need to do in order to satisfy that that for them. Then it goes to the conduct review office. And so everything beyond that point is really kind of what takes significant time in the process, and really don't want to assign blame to anybody. It's just the process. And then after that process, essentially every case goes to the end of a very long line. And I think that it's that long line that relates to the length of time that it takes to resolve a case. And so I'd like to shorten that line and keep things from going to the back of that long line so that it shortens over time. So that's the hope. Okay, next slide. So here is the discipline process with education-based development if the officer were to sign the agreement. So after the Office of the Independent Monitor has reviewed the investigation and given their recommendation, a final determination will be made regarding whether education-based development is appropriate. If the case is approved for education-based development, an agreement letter is developed by Internal Affairs and our Professional Development Unit and signed by the involved officer. The officer will have 3 business days to decide whether to accept and sign the agreement. If they don't sign the agreement within 3 business days, the discipline process will proceed and education-based development will no longer be an option. If the officer agrees, the professional development unit, in concert with our academy, will coordinate the assignment of classes and document education-based training in the shared database. Training will be made available within 30 days and will be completed within 90 days of signing the agreement. Once the training is complete, the Internal Affairs Commander will ensure that the education-based development agreement has been fulfilled and the case will be closed. If an officer fails to complete any part of the agreement, the case will continue through the disciplinary process, and all of this will be documented in the shared database. So as you can see here, if the officer does not accept education-based development, the case continues through the normal disciplinary process. Next. So why is Denver contemplating adopting education-based discipline? So from 2022 to 2025, 66% of all cases could have been eligible for education-based development. Instead, these cases have clogged our disciplinary process, taking several months to resolve, which I think is unacceptable for a complainant to wait this long. And I think that in and of itself erodes trust. Now, I emphasize could have been eligible because the way our analysis will go is, you know, the first determination will be, does this infraction that is alleged against an officer, is this one of the 66 that's ineligible? If it is one of the 66, then it goes through the normal disciplinary process. The next analysis will be, is this part of some continuing pattern? Is this a repeat offense? If the answer to any of those questions is yes, then it goes through the normal disciplinary process. And then the third analysis, which I think I've shared with a number of you, is based upon the case specifics, is it determined that this is a mistake of the head or a mistake of the heart? If it's a mistake of the head where they clearly just didn't know what they were supposed to do, then I think the most appropriate outcome is to help them understand both what they were supposed to do and what the department and the community expectation is, if it's in the state of the heart where they did know what they were supposed to do but just elected not to do that anyway, then that's clearly a case where we need to proceed with the normal discipline. Next slide. So this represents last year's disciplinary outcome. So of the 713 internal affairs cases filed against officers last year, these have been the outcomes. So 261 were declined for further investigation with the agreement of the Office of the Independent Monitor. 122 had informal outcomes. So these were cases where, which, you know, we think were more cautionary rather than identifications of significant misconduct. 106 cases were not sustained, and of the 204 which remained that were sustained, 45 received a written reprimand, 68 received an oral reprimand, 37 received a fine of 1 to 2 days, 33 received a suspension or a fine of more than 2 days, and then there were 21 cases where there were terminations or people resigned in lieu of termination. I think it's important to point out that we complete every single case, regardless of whether or not the officer separates. We think that that's important. You know, we want to make sure that we're able to report to post if there has been a post-reportable offense that's been committed by that officer. We want to make sure that we are reporting that to post. We also want to make sure that we're maintaining that in our records so that if this person chooses to go to another department, that department is going to reach out to us and we will be able to say, well, you know, they left our department, but had they remained, there's this case where we would have to do that. That's important to communicate to other departments, LMM, so that we don't have gypsy officers that are just, you know, engaging in misconduct and then moving on before they're held accountable. So here, next slide, thank you. So here, as you can see, regardless of the disciplinary outcome, cases generally take 6 to 8 months and often up to a year or more to resolve. I believe it is a disservice for any complainant to wait nearly a year for a resolution to a complaint that they filed. Not only should complainants receive closure in a reasonable amount of time, but officers who engage in misconduct should receive corrective action promptly. Now I'm looking at this holistically, looking at overall behavior change, so an officer who does not have the understanding or awareness will go forward with the ability to apply learned skills in every aspect of their performance. I'm focused on reducing the number of officers committing violations and on identifying root causes. Next slide. So what has stakeholder engagement looked like? So initial introduction of the concept was shared with the following groups. Chief's Community Advisory Group, which is 14 individuals, extremely diverse backgrounds, members of multiple faith communities, and, you know, former council aides, members that represent the immigrant community. So I think a pretty diverse group of folks. That was the first group that I introduced the concept to, Greater Denver Ministerial Alliance, Together Colorado, Office of the Independent Monitor, our Police Protective Association, who everyone understands is our bargaining union, various peer law enforcement agencies, and then mental health and academic partners. It's important to note that this was not sharing of a policy draft with any of these entities. It was merely just introducing the concept for public input and making tweaks to our framework. We didn't hear any objections, just suggestions that we incorporated into the framework and subsequent policy drafts. Next. So following discussions with the Office of the Independent Monitor and Citizen Oversight Board, several suggestions were incorporated into the current policy draft and additional community feedback was sought. So this included 10 attendees at 6 different community meetings in each of the police districts, community members that are on our community engagement distribution list that I'll get into a little bit deeper. Again, obviously the Independent Monitor, as well as the Denver Civil Service Commission. Important to note again that no one saw a draft except for the Office of the Independent Monitor. And we ultimately did incorporate most of the OIM's recommendations into the current policy draft, which has since been placed on our webpage for further feedback. Next page, yes. So as I talked about, the people that expressed interest in having follow-up engagement with the police department, all of you are probably aware of our spider tech technology, where anyone who calls 911 from a cell phone begins getting text messages back. Those initial text messages are in relation to the response, whether or not it's delayed, whether or not officers are responding at that moment. And then they get text messages after the call has been completed, where you can evaluate the performance of just not just the dispatcher, but also the responding officer. There's also a place within the survey where you can indicate your desire to have further communication with the police department. Thousands of people have checked that box and have indicated interest in having that that follow-on engagement. And we received over 800 responses from that tool. And as you can see, to the question, do you agree with this program concept? 78% said yes. Do you believe the program will have a positive impact on an officer's behavior? 62% said yes. Do you believe this program will have a positive impact on police community relations? 61% said yes. Do you believe this program will enhance the safety of community members? 54% said yes. The Citizens Oversight Panel provided this survey data. Next slide. Thank you. So I don't disagree that some agencies' education-based development programs are overbroad. I'm proposing a program which is much more strict than many other programs we looked at. We are not allowing education-based development for any case where suspension or any sort of significant discipline is appropriate. There is an appendix attached to the policy which highlights those cases which are, or those complaints which are eligible. And remember, 66 of those 127 violations are automatically ineligible. Next. So education-based development is not eligible, as I've said, for more serious offenses where presumptive penalties are higher than minor reprimands, such as sexual misconduct, force complaints, integrity complaints, EEO violations, bias incidents, or repeated incidents or patterns. Again, these are cases where we want to impose discipline where appropriate as timely as possible. So in cases of minor rule violations, training will be designed around them taking accountability. I believe acknowledging a mistake was made and agreeing to receive better training to better understand ongoing expectations is accountability. I would argue that this absolutely addresses the harm to the community. And wouldn't community want our officers to be more well-rounded, skilled, and better critical thinkers, maintaining a high level of respect for the communities that they serve? We incorporate community respect and potential harms into several of our current trainings to include active bystandership in law enforcement, before the badge, professional policing leadership institute, and our anti-bias training. So why wouldn't we use those same elements in augmenting our specialized training designed around specific violations? I believe education-based discipline will be effective as it will be fairly and reasonably administered. And will ensure clarity and expectations through specific training will strengthen relationships and trust by better ensuring understanding of policies and procedures. Also, timeliness relates to trust and ensuring better outcomes. Next. So relative to evaluation and monitoring, I believe these corrective approaches focused on education, coaching, and engagement can strengthen individual responsibility, long-term learning, and behavior change, which are key components of accountability. An evaluation will identify whether the intended outcomes are achieved without unintended consequences. We have contracted with a university partner to conduct a robust data-informed study of the effectiveness of the program to include an upfront diagnostic review of our discipline process and evidence of positive outcomes. And lastly, regarding transparency, to include community transparency along with our transparency with the Office of the Independent Monitor, outcomes will be added to the current complaint dashboard, which is available on our transparency page on our website, or there will be a separate dashboard created so that people can clearly see what cases are being diverted to education-based development, what offenses, what officers, so that they can verify for themselves that there are no allegations that shouldn't have gone that route, or there are no repeat offenses. Again, everything related to citizen and internal complaints will be uploaded into the shared database so that OIM always has access and the opportunity to view what's going on. So, questions?
Hey, I have a number of folks in the queue. I have Councilman Flynn, Cashman, Gonzalez Gutierrez, Parity, Watson, Council Torres. And then Alvidrez, Councilman Flynn, you want to start us off?
Sure, thank you. Thank you, Chief. And I appreciated the listing in the draft that showed the various complaints categories that could lead to the disciplinary process, because I was struck by how many of them I would never have thought of. There was one, damaging your badge, was on there. And so I think a lot of folks in the public, when they hear police complaints, they think of the ones that make the news, brutality, inappropriate use of force, et cetera. And just to be clear, those are not on the people.
Absolutely.
So it seems to me that when I looked at your flow chart, the difference between what we do now and what you're proposing is that once an investigation is done into whatever the complaint is, whether it's you damaged your badge or you loaned it to another officer or whatever, or you pulled your firearm when you shouldn't have, whatever it is, those are investigated equally to a certain point, and at that decision point, right now, they all go into that long line.
Correct.
That you're trying to resolve.
Correct.
So the difference here is those that are on the list that could be diverted to EBD out of the academy, the staff would put together a course. It could be different depending on what the complaint was, and the officer completes that satisfactorily. And the difference is that it doesn't result in an oral reprimand or whatever would have happened had it gone through that 1 year or the 400 days.
Right.
Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, and so I think the points to really hammer home are that thorough investigation is completed on every, so that means talking to all involved officers, every single witness. You know, we want to really understand exactly what happened and why so that we can answer those questions. Was this a mistake of the head or a mistake of the heart? Then obviously there's, we want to make sure that this is or isn't one of those ineligible cases. And we also want to identify patterns of conduct. Now, once we determine that it is appropriate for education-based development, now we want to, given those facts, we want to develop a very incident-specific training. So again, I want to make it clear that this is not sitting in front of a computer watching videos. This is like our academy staff, our professional development, putting together a training testing.
So at the academy?
Out at the academy, so that at the end of it, it's very clear that they understand the policy procedure that they were to follow, the impact that they had on the community, what the expectation is of community and of the department.
What would really help me, and I suppose a lot of those who might be watching on Channel 8, is could you give maybe two examples of actual cases that could have gone through this and how the outcome would have been handled? without using names.
Yeah, certainly. So one that comes to mind, I probably have shared with a number of you, is, so let's say there is, and I think many of you have council districts that share borders with other cities. So let's say an officer responds to an accident. When they get there, they make the determination, no, this isn't Denver, this is Sheridan, this is Aurora. Ma'am, I can't take your report. You need to call Aurora, Sheridan, whoever. They do that, they call Sheridan or Aurora, they show up and they're like, oh no, this is absolutely not our jurisdiction, this is Denver. So now they have to call Denver back and somebody has to come and take that report. Now this person has wasted 5 hours of their life waiting for an accident to be reported, which is already a traumatic event.
That sounds like my district every day.
Yeah, and so we would get that complaint. We would recognize that there actually is a policy that says in a jurisdictional dispute, you will complete the report and we will figure out the jurisdictional issues later. I think it's reasonable that, you know, in an operations manual that's thicker than a phone book, that might be something that was lost, forgotten. I think that if you were to educate an officer on what the department expectation is there, what the exact policy and procedure is there, help them understand the impact that they had on that particular citizen, and also help them understand what the department and the community expectation is. My guess is they will never do that again. If they did do that again, then I think it seems very willful. Like, yeah, I knew that maybe I should have taken the report, but I just didn't choose to.
So this is one strike in your out.
Yeah. So the next time that they did that, obviously that would not be.
So we have a policy already that when there's a misunderstanding or dispute about where that accident is, I'm thinking of Bellevue and Wadsworth, there's three jurisdictions that merge there. And the Denver officer responding, even if the officer thinks it's in Lakewood or an unincorporated Jeffco, that officer is supposed to take that report anyway. If the officer doesn't, and the people in the accident complain, right now that would be fully investigated, and it could go into that long line that's clogging up higher level complaints from being resolved. So if the officer says, no, I'm sorry, this is Lakewood, give them a call. That officer will be called in, mm-hmm. possibly go to the training. Mm-hmm. If it's the first time.
Okay.
I think I get it. I know there's a lot too many other people in the queue for a second example, but if you have other examples, maybe email them to us, because I'd like to get a better understanding.
Sure.
The kinds of things that would be taken out of that.
Oh,
there it is. Taken out of that long line.
Yes.
And what does that do? Well, we don't know what it'll do for improvement of officer performance, but
so
what will it do to public satisfaction?
Yeah. So my strong hypothesis is that it will lessen complaints, that it will certainly address recidivism, and that it will shorten the process, particularly for low level, but I think ultimately shorten the process for the more significant cases, because we won't keep sending people to the end of that long line, and that line will just progressively get shorter. So that is the hypothesis, and those are the outcomes that we will be studying to make sure that it works. I want to be very clear with this group that if those outcomes turn out not to be true, then I would discontinue the practice.
Thank you, Mayor. I understand there was an accident right there at Bellevue and Wadsworth, and the jurisdiction was decided by where the victim was thrown from the vehicle and where the victim's head landed, because literally straddling the three lines.
Helpful example. Thank you, Councilman Flynn. Councilman Cashman.
Thank you, Mayor. Thanks for the presentation, Chief. And thanks for the briefing one-on-one we did. I've had the opportunity to talk to you at length about this, excuse me, and the opportunity to talk to Monitor Castle as well. I respect you both completely. Y'all are on different pages, and I don't think this is cooked. This is not, I don't even want to go into, you know, details and he said, they said, whatever. But y'all are on different, vastly different pages. And so I think you need to get on the same page as close as possible. And I would just encourage sort of a discussion between you, the monitor, the COB. I understand where you're trying to go, and I don't think that I have a hard problem with that.
Sure.
But like I said, I think the interpretation of whether or not oversight is being shortchanged differs. Mm-hmm. And I do not want the monitor shortchanged.
Certainly.
In the course of what you're trying to, and I believe that to be true, sir. I believe that to be true. Thank you.
Thanks, Councilman Cashman. Next up, Councilman Gonzalez Gutierrez.
Thank you, Mayor. And thank you, Chief, and thank you for the time that we kind of walked through some of this stuff. Do we have this publicly posted, this slideshow deck show?
Oh, that'd be a question.
Because I couldn't find it on Legistar. So that would be great, just because I'm trying to go back and want to look at, you know, comparing this to the other slide, and it's difficult to do that because I don't have access to this slide deck.
Yeah, I can make that available, sir.
Okay, thank you. But also to the public, that would be great. One question that I have is about the information that you had on one of the slides that said that this is actually evidence-based practice. Having worked in, you know, the social sciences field, evidence-based means a very specific thing, right? It means that it has gone through a rigorous process, an evaluation process that is rigorous, academic. It's also very expensive for a lot of programs to go through that process. I'm curious if, because sometimes people utilize the term evidence-based kind of in a catch-all, but it is a very specific thing. Sure. Do you have the information that the source of showing that this is in fact evidence-based?
Well, so I think the correct answer to that is there probably is currently no evidence-based that this works in policing, because while 60 plus agencies across the country and in Canada have done it, they have not done their own science-based analysis, or if it is, it's just not available, nor have any of the bodies like ICP PERF done that. But I think that the concept, I think there is evidence bases that providing education, training, coaching, development do work to change behavior in many other disciplines. And so, again, recognizing that it is probably a true statement that there is no true science-based work that shows that this is effective, I want to create my own study to demonstrate that it works, which is why from the very beginning I've engaged with a university partner to study those outcomes.
Okay. I would just ask that, like, we make sure that we're properly using these types of terminology, because they can be misconstrued to mean something different, because sure. As I stated, evidence-based practices, this particular model is not an evidence-based practice. So I just want to be clear on that, because there is no research, as far as I can tell, and I've seen, there is no actual research substantiating that fact.
Correct, in policing, but in other disciplines to criminal
justice. We're talking about it for, in the case of with policing,
yeah.
When we're looking at the stakes in different types of situations, fair. When you're looking at different types of jobs, we're talking about folks who have a badge and a gun, who have the ultimate authority over someone's life, right? And so I just want to be very cautious about how we're putting information out there. That's all that I'm asking.
Yeah. No, appreciate that.
And then the next question, and I'll let somebody else get in because I know everybody's in the queue. Can you go over the type of conduct where this would be applied? I know that when you and I met, you talked about specific types of violations, and you've kind of touched on a couple of them here today. But I'm just curious, what exactly are those violations?
Well, primarily they are violations relative to... I mean, generally administrative in nature. So the officer did not complete a certain report that they were required to complete. An officer did not follow a certain policy that they were required to follow. They didn't handle property the way that they are required to handle property. So these again are not situations that involve, you know, bias complaints or forced complaints, integrity issues, EEO issues, you know, anything that you know anyone would deem to be serious in nature would be off the table. And so I know that very early on I kind of talked about things that fall between category A and category C. I think that was overly broad. You know, looking more closely at those the violations that fall in those various categories, I was able to actually identify some that do fall in those categories that I wouldn't want, nor would anybody else want to be considered. And so that's why those 66 specifically were determined to be ineligible.
Can we get a list of the violations that would be considered for this process?
Yeah, I mean, it's already on the...
Is it all on the... Okay. Well, I can't go back to it, so that's
why... Yeah. It's part of the appendix, so it's publicly available today.
Okay.
And so people have been able to view that, make comments about that. So that is being tracked right now.
I think the last thing I'll just say is that, you know, even if it is a quote-unquote administrative, like, violation, right, where something is not filed properly or things like that, those still can have detrimental impacts.
Absolutely.
To victims and you know, in the entire justice system as a whole, right? And I have seen that play out over decades in not only the work that I've done in juvenile justice space, child welfare, and then also as a council member and just ongoing you know, conversations and information that I receive from people who are victims of crimes and whose cases are being mishandled, right? And so those are not minor violations because they have pretty significant impact on somebody's life.
Yeah.
So I do want to say, like, it's, although it may not be a police brutality case or it may not be, you know, so straightforward that someone is being harmed, someone is being harmed.
Yeah.
And so I just want to
let
make sure we're talking about
let that. And I appreciate that distinction. So, which is why, you know, I think that we want to be very careful in our training to make sure that we are not just addressing what the appropriate policy and procedure is to follow, but helping them understand what that community expectation is, what that impact was on that victim, which I think is accomplished through a comprehensive training rather than an oral reprimand or a letter in an officer's file. Well, certainly we could do both, but the problem with doing both is that what are we going to do about that long line that has caused cases to take such a long time to resolve?
Thank you. I'll let somebody else go.
Councilwoman Parody.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here, Chief. Trying to think where to start. First of all, I think I want to just verify that I have the right understanding of the problems that you're trying to solve. One of them is the length of the time that the investigations take, and I hear you on that. One of them is that you want to lean into having officers that are getting really good training and education. Or is there anything else that I'm missing?
I think I do want to address recidivism, and I also want to make sure that we are having much more just a better overall outcome, a solution-based outcome rather than just a letter and a file.
Okay. What other solutions have you considered to try to shorten the length of time of investigations?
Well, that's completely out of my control. So obviously the Monitor Castle and I have discussed the length of time that the cases take. And again, I assign no blame for the reason why it takes such a long time for the process. It just does. And I think that, again, one of the best ways to shorten the line is to reduce the number of cases that go to the end of that line. I think we have to be very thoughtful about which cases it is that we are not putting to the back of that line. So we certainly don't want to just shorten the line for the sake of shortening the line. We want to make sure that we're doing it with the right cases.
But for example, wouldn't like more staffing in both IAB and OIM shorten the time? I mean, it would be hard for me to imagine that we couldn't, that there couldn't be other ways, at least conceptually, that we could get those investigations to move more quickly.
Well, I mean, I guess the answer to your specific question is we certainly could. You know, I won't speak for a monitor, but it would be difficult for me to remove staff from another assignment and place them in internal affairs. But again, it's not just the length of time that is the issue. It is, I think, the ineffective outcome that isn't solution oriented.
Okay. Yeah, and that's a different bucket of kind of the issues that you're solving for. So I wanted to ask you about the time because I do hear that concern. Mm-hmm. So getting to the list of violations, I really want to lean in on this. And Councilmember Flynn, it goes to kind of what you were asking about, which is just the idea that these are minor violations. I put the list out to a number of sort of like people who have experience in the world of police misconduct. And I got responses back that were, people were sort of stunned. And here's like an example of one of these emails. Some of these are violations we routinely see in cases where officers are abusing their authority and violating the Constitution. In particular, the body-worn camera policy. Body-worn cameras can be turned off to not record what's supposed to be on them. They also might be turned off because someone forgot them, right? Like it could be either motivation. But there's nothing about that offense that is inherently minor. It can be extremely serious, right? Same thing with discourtesy. I mean, that can be minor or it can be extremely not minor, right?
Without a doubt.
Depending what an officer says to someone. Duty to obey rules and mayoral orders. A lot of really serious police misconduct, the way that everything, you know, our rules are structured right now, free speech violations would fall under that. So mm-hmm. First Amendment violations, which are serious, that's a constitutional issue. Giving your name and badge number, that is an exceptionally serious matter at times because sometimes that might be, again, sort of a miscommunication. Sometimes it might be about trying to make sure that someone can't pursue a claim against you after a protest. We've had officers cover up their badges during protests. That's not a minor thing. I mean, it just isn't. In addition, the example about loaning your badge to someone else, that strikes me as really serious. I don't want someone who's not a cop running around with a badge. So I just think like the problem is that if we try to categorize these things as minor because they are sometimes minor, innocent, forgivable, then we're having to trust whoever is making the decision about which route to put people on to distinguish between those things. And we don't always know those things. Evidence handling and report writing are fundamental and crucial to police accountability. If we do not know that someone is writing accurate reports, and a lot of times that's only uncovered in the investigation. So I have seen this so many times, and I'll give an example of a case where I was representing an exceptional cop. He was a sergeant. He had gotten like every possible medal in the Greenwood Village Police Department. His name is Pat Sello. He tried to unionize his department with IUPA, and he ran into a bunch of opposition from the existing chief and lieutenants who were all FOP. And he ended up getting fired for supposedly not having supervised a search correctly. And come to find out, as we litigated his case, because their disciplinary system was discretionary, the discipline had been incredibly unequal between people who were union members and people who were FOP members, and a bunch of the reports had been fudged to make the union people seem more accountable. And the only way that came out was because we litigated that case. So I just can't see us going down this road. Like, I don't think any of the violations are uniformly and always minor because it always depends on context.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
And we can't remove oversight to determine.
We're not removing oversight. I mean, we are conducting the full and thorough investigation to get answers to all of those questions that you raised, to determine all of those impacts, to determine whether this is local conduct. And we're doing that hand in hand with the Office of the Independent Monitor. So we're not going to shortchange an investigation and not get answers to questions that are important to have answers to, and have the Office of the Independent Monitor say, well, I don't think that we've answered the question as to whether or not you know what I'm saying? So I don't believe that we're removing oversight at all, and we're actually making certain that we have answers to all of those questions to determine. I mean, with the process that's in place, you're able to see the numbers of cases where the outcome was the slide that you were actually previously on. The outcomes of oral reprimands versus written reprimands versus one to due date fines. I think the one after that.
The flow chart one.
So
two forward?
Yeah, the kind of squiggly line looking one.
One more forward? Keep going.
Oh, the one I was on.
Yeah, there you go. So you know, those that are in green, again, those are ones that you know that everyone agreed that was the appropriate outcome, and I would say that even all of those would not necessarily be considered for education-based development, because we would have to look at, was this willful? Was this a pattern of conduct? But I think that, you know, when everyone on both sides agreed that the appropriate outcome was a written reprimand, I think that the more appropriate outcome to a written reprimand is actually 8 or 16 hours of training, so that you walk away clearly with an understanding of what you should have done, and also so that you have a clear understanding of what the impact of that community member was and what the community expectation is.
Right, and my concern,
I just
want
to be mindful, Council, I have 4 other folks in the queue, okay. So maybe 30 more seconds, we'll move on.
If we cut short, if we're not using our full process, we may not uncover some of the things that can be so insidious about these kinds of violations. That I just don't see how we can have it both ways, like both shorten the process and not lose some of that incredibly important insight and accountability. So I'll leave that there.
No, I just think that the important piece to remain intact is the investigation, because that is where you get the answers to all of those questions.
So if you go back two slides to the disciplinary process with EBD. So this slide indicates you would have a complete and thorough investigation into internal affairs. The completeness and thoroughness of that investigation would then be certified by OIM. You would then make a recommendation about education-based development. OIM would then be able to review that recommendation and provide input on it before it then went to education-based development. So there are 3 checks on the complete and thorough investigation before a decision is made to go to EBD.
Correct.
Great, thank you. Next, I have Councilman Watson.
Thank you. I was going to call you Council President, Mayor Johnston. Thank you, Chief Thomas, for being here, and I appreciate the walking through of the checks on this slide, because I don't think it came out clearly in your last response. I wanted to say, as the chair of the Health and Safety Committee, my normal process would have been, sir, to have you present before Health and Safety, provide the briefings to council members, and then receive input from any of the organizations that are monitoring, reviewing the efficacy of this proposed policy. That process did not occur in this step, and we'll make sure with any future training or any other changes within disciplinary process within your team that we follow that process, because I think it's important to hear this information and then receive feedback from other partners. My question, and I have two, can you describe, you stated that the Office of Independent Monitor has had the opportunity to review the recommendations provided, and there were a certain number of those that were accepted. Talk through that process with the Office of Independent Monitor for reviewing really the efficacy of this possible rollout.
So I think, you know, in full transparency, you know, I have been contemplating a model for addressing those concerns that I've enumerated for over a year. And so I introduced, at the time it was called education-based discipline, I sort of introduced that concept. And had a number of discussions with Monitor Castle about that. And, you know, she seemed interested in seeing exactly what I put together and what I put in front of her. I ultimately did put a framework in front of her, and then later put a policy in front of her, which I thought she made several very thoughtful recommendations. I lose track of the number of thoughtful recommendations were. And I think to date, the current policy includes, I think, 28 of those recommendations. So nearly all of the recommendations, and actually one of the recommendations that I was resistant to, having conversations with a couple of members of council and hearing their feedback, there is actually one additional change that I want to make to the policy, and that relates to the credit for training. And so, like, let's say, you know, so every officer by policy, by post standard, has to receive 24 hours of continuing education credit every year. 12 of those have to be in perishable skills, so shooting, driving, arrest control. So initially, I was open to the idea of, let's say they have 8 hours of education-based development for a specific infraction, having that count towards that 24-hour total, but not towards the 12 hours of perishable skills. Having had some feedback from some of your colleagues, I have decided that would be, you know, that we would make those 8 hours in addition to that 24-hour total. So so while they would certainly get, you know, additional credit, it wouldn't go towards that 24-hour requirement. And so, you know, we have, you know, I would say most officers go well past the 24-hour limit of required hours of continuing education. And so this would be just another instance where they would have 24 hours of required and these 8 hours that were mandated by the discipline.
Thank you, Chief. I got two quick questions, and I hope that you're able to provide a succinct answer, because I think we have part of this while it's in the queue. I wanted you to clarify again, this training for that you're proposing, this is in-person, on-site training. Folks aren't doing this on their iPads in their cars.
That's correct. And, you know, and so this is, you know, they are being removed from their assignment and sent to the academy to receive this training.
And the follow-up process to identify outcomes, to evaluate if this goes into practice, describe the relationship with the university that you're working with, and what's the ongoing feedback from the dashboard, et cetera, for there to be transparency to the community as far as which disciplinary steps or this training is being a part of. Walk through that a little bit.
Yeah, so quickly, so we have partnered with the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and they will be the ones responsible for gathering the outcome data and making a determination whether or not the outcomes that I believe will improve have actually improved. And again, committing to, if they haven't improved, then I would discontinue the practice, because that's the only reason why I would be doing this. And then relative to the transparency piece, obviously there's continued transparency with the Office of the Independent Monitor, because all of these things will be entered into the database that we both share, so there's constant awareness. But also we have, for at least the last 2 years plus, had a transparency page on our dashboard, on our DPD webpage, that allows people to see disciplinary outcomes. This will be yet another tab that they can see disciplinary outcomes specifically as they relate to education-based development.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
I just wanted to jump in something that you said, Councilmember Watson. This conversation had been happening a lot more before I changed committees. Mm-hmm. So, yes, you did develop a new process as you became chair July 21st. But Councilwoman Gonzalez Gutierrez had been working on this for a really long time and attempting to bring both parties together, and had numerous requests. I've seen them. So I just want to say on the record that, yes, you are currently the chair now, but Councilwoman Gonzalez Gutierrez had been working on that, and I just didn't feel like that was a fair statement to say that your process is different than hers when she was chair and she did a really good job. And she really did attempt to have this come together to have a conversation, and it didn't happen. I won't get into that right now, but I just wanted to clear the record to not make it feel like Councilwoman Gonzalez-Gutierrez had not attempted to do what you were doing, because I just feel like communication matters right now amongst all of us and how we approach things and really thinking about having EQ in these conversations and not blaming somebody is going to be something that I'm going to hold all of us accountable for, because she really did do a great job chairing for a while.
Comfortable with that, Council President. I was speaking solely to my process as a chair, making sure that it was clear.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Council Torres.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you so much, Chief. I really have to agree with my colleague, Councilman Cashman. I don't think this is ready to be implemented, if only because I'm watching so much critique of consequence or failure to agree with the monitor's office, because I couldn't claim to be an expert on how we arrive at certain disciplinary charges or what process should look like according to the matrix or any of those things. And so when there is this level of disagreement, I think it deeply sows mistrust that something's not being done correctly. And I do want to have confidence that you're approaching this because of really good methods and interests in the goal. But that level of disagreement, I think, is hard to ignore. One thing that I'll say from the letter that the Citizen Oversight Board shared with Council is an area that I think, from an outside perspective, feels really uncomfortable, is that there is no agreement as to what qualifies as a low-level offense between the DPD investigators and the monitor's office. So if I'm looking at this, I could presumably say that something could get categorized as discourtesy when it's in fact intimidation, or when it is presumably something else that could be more severe. And without that level of agreement or consultation, I would struggle that we would be letting some officers go through EBD for discourtesy or, you know, name another that might have been otherwise qualified as a different kind of category. So just to have that kind of confidence, because I don't want DPD, I think under your leadership, has really grown in my eyes in terms of what you've embraced and the kinds of programs to garner public trust. I wouldn't want to see that eroded because we launched into something without everyone's understanding or appreciation for why we're doing that and how. So just my thoughts on, I think, that piece. And I hope that, like Councilman Cashman mentioned, this can be launched with more more folks on board. Thank you.
Councilwoman Abidres.
Thank you so much, Mayor. Thank you for the presentation of the thorough. It does seem like there has been some evolution over the time of the process. So I'm curious if it's okay if I could ask Office of the Independent Monitor if they have seen a change in this compared to what was presented in committee.
I don't know that we're going to have time for multiple witnesses this morning. I encourage you to check with the monitor after if you want to, but I'm going to get through our other two. I do have a 10:30. Other folks may as well. And so I think would encourage you for sure to have that conversation offline. We just weren't ready to do multiple witnesses today.
All right. One of my questions, comments have been made previously about the trainings, that why aren't all these trainings included in the standard training? And these trainings seem great. So I just wanted to hear your response to that thought.
Well, they are. I mean, you know, 28-week academy, and so a lot of these things are trained. So, you know, I would say most of our policies and procedures, particularly the ones that people engage in every day, are trained at the academy and in field training. But I think that just in every profession, the amount of rule and regulation is just so vast and broad that I think that it leads to an opportunity to forget, to misunderstand, and I think those, you know, the identification of those misunderstandings is a perfect opportunity to jump in and make sure that somebody is adequately trained going forward.
Great. And then when you were talking about, is this something of the head or the heart, how are you determining that?
Well, I think the facts really determine that. And so, you know, if you know, having interviewed the officer, having interviewed the, you know, the complainant, having interviewed both the civilian and the uniform witnesses that are on scene, I think that we generally do get a pretty good sense of whether or not this was willful or not. And I think that that also determines what the ultimate outcome is going to be. Is there going to be aggravation applied? Is there going to be mitigation applied? And so I think that we can get the answers to those questions so that we can determine whether or not it's a mistake of the heart or a mistake of the head during that process. I think also, you know, because all of these things are tracked and all of these things are able for us all to view, we can also understand if an officer makes repeated, maybe not the same mistake, but repeated mistakes of policy violations, well, I think that that lends itself to a different type of outcome that's necessary there, where we actually do need to begin to apply some very progressive discipline to that person so that they have an understanding that you can't just keep making these foolish mistakes. Even if you don't mean to, you do have some responsibility to have a greater understanding of policy procedure. And if you don't know, ask.
I appreciate that. I think overall, I'm open to this conversation and this policy because I think, you know, as a mother, as a supervisor, when someone makes a mistake, I always try to talk to them about it and figure out what's going on before it's just a punishment maybe that has an impact on their financial stability or their home life or that resentfulness, which makes me worried. So I just want to pin that there. And then the other thing that has come up as a part of this with the COB and the civil service was just the open vacancies. And I don't know if you've been able to fill those yet, Mr. Mayor.
The vacancies in which
on the committees on the civil service committee, there was someone that has that their term is up, and we haven't your office,
citizen oversight board,
the civil service commission and the citizen oversight board both have vacancies.
I can check them out and get back to you.
Okay, thank you.
The next, Councilman Lewis.
Thanks for the presentation. I have a few questions for you. Can you help me to understand the training and the curriculum aspect of it? Can you just give me an understanding of what's a part of the training?
Yeah, so obviously we want to make sure that there is training specific to the violation. So, you know, going back to our operations manual, going back to the specific policies, training bulletins that may be available, just the specific site in the operations manual where that describes that particular policy. So I think that is a component of the training to make sure that they clearly understand what the department expectation is by policy. Then I think next, I think that depending on the violation, I think certainly there are procedural justice components that need to be folded in, emotional intelligence components that need to be folded in. You know, we have received outcry actually from educators that believe that I think this is a great idea, but you should probably include this in the training. You know, so and then, you know, when I showed on the slide that I've engaged with people in the mental health field and the education field, I mean, people have reached out to me saying, you know, I actually think this is a great idea and something that we do in our profession. But I think you need to make sure that you include these components. And so we have taken that advice. We have elicited the support of people in those fields to help us build those very specific training components within the training.
So when you say that you have folks reach out to you to add additional pieces to the training, How are you putting that together? Like, what does execution look like? What are the different components? Are folks a part of a cohort? Like, no. What is this?
So you know, as was shown in the presentation, so the framework, several sides of framework were sent to thousands of people and also made available to people at six different community meetings. And there was a QR code that allowed them to provide feedback later. And so we took account of all of that feedback, and some of that feedback was, I am an educator, and this is what I think about your program, and this is what I think would make it better. Or I am in the mental health field, and this is what I think about your program, and this is what I think would make it better. And so, you know, I think, you know, we have given people the opportunity to provide feedback and be able to incorporate not just that feedback, but the feedback that we receive from now, so the independent monitor, into the current policy, the current draft policy. And then, you know, the policy is now available since the 20th of July, and we continue to get feedback there. Very thoughtful and helpful feedback.
Who will deliver the training?
So it will be delivered by, for the most part, our personal development team, which is a branch of our internal affairs division and our academy.
Okay, so if they're taking pieces of recommendations from other folks, these aren't necessarily experts in terms of that delivery, they're just the conveners of and the creators of,
I would say,
curriculum, and then they're delivering it more as facilitators more so than experts.
Well, I think if there is a need to bring in an expert in emotional intelligence or procedural justice, we could certainly do that. But I would say that our trainers are expert in the delivery of training because they're all certified.
We'll probably disagree on that one, but I do have one follow-up for you. So you mentioned the current, you mentioned recidivism as one of the goals that you wanted to accomplish. I'm curious as what the recidivism data is currently, and then what's the goal that you all have outlined in terms of that reduction?
Well, so I would say that I don't have the numbers in front of me as to what that recidivism actually is, but it is there is recidivism. There is an instance of officers repeating the same mistake four or five times, as well as a number of officers repeating the same mistake twice. I think that's the most frequent occurrence of people repeating the same mistake twice. And so we certainly want to address that. I would like to eliminate that altogether. But I think that by continuing to impress upon people what the community expectation is and the department expectation is, I think that that will lower overall complaints.
Yeah, it'd be helpful to know like what the baseline is for recidivism, mm-hmm. so that I can understand what you all are trying to accomplish in terms of that.
And I think that's one of the, you know, the benefits of having a university partner establish that baseline, and then be able to compare where we get to at the end of a study period to that baseline.
Okay, and then my final question.
Last one, Councilman.
That's what I said. My final question is, how do you objectively measure a mistake of the heart, and how do you objectively measure a mistake of the mind?
Again, I think that that is very clear in the investigation. I think that it is very clear in all of the actions that you know, that you know, like if we go back to the to the example that I gave of not taking the report on a jurisdictional boundary, I think that there are other behaviors, like let's say on top of it, the officer was rude, or the officer made it seem like, I don't have time for this, you need to call somebody else. I just think that, you know, in my experience, having spent three tours in internal affairs, I think it's actually very easy with the full breadth of the investigation to determine whether or not somebody just plain didn't know what they were supposed to do, or if they did know, but they chose to do otherwise anyway.
It feels more subjective. I was worried. I was curious of what an objective measure would be for both of those.
Well, I don't know. I mean, help me understand how you would objectively determine whether or not somebody, you know, if you bumped into somebody in the hallway, I don't know how you would be able to determine objectively if that was an intentional or an accidental act. You know, I think that you would have to take a number of other factors into consideration to determine whether or not they meant to do that or it was purely an accident.
I agree, and that's why I worry, is
sure.
that it's very subjective sure.
and
going to be dependent
yeah.
on who's...
And you know, and I don't intend for these decisions to be made, you know, in a vacuum. I don't intend for these decisions to be made lightly, and I don't even intend for these decisions to be made by one person. And so, so I think that there are several opportunities for us to make sure that we have the right outcome and that we make that right determination as to whether or not this is something that training is best for or strict discipline is best for.
Thank you.
Thank you.
President Pro Tem, you have the last very brief question.
I do, and actually it's a wrap up. So thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Chief, for being
yes.
here. And maybe this is more of a question for you. Just hearing, you know, my colleagues' questions, still concern for some process. What's next? Like, what happens after this meeting? What's the next step in the process?
Sure, I can defer to Chief on that, but I'll give my initial answer, the Chief can add. Obviously, appreciate Chief's commitment to gather community feedback on this, to gather feedback from independent monitors, Citizens Oversight Board, and council members. He is ultimately in charge of leading and running his department in the same way all 27 agency heads in the city are in charge of leading and running their department. And that includes making programmatic decisions like this one. So that is in his purview to make this decision. I think we always want to make sure we have feedback and thought partnership in that design, but that is certainly within his power to make the decision for how to run this operation. I think for me, what we're looking at is how do we make sure we've heard all the feedback and comments and we've delivered a system that addresses those concerns. I think we are all entirely committed to making sure that folks learn from mistakes and get better. We're entirely committed to making sure that folks that abuse their power or misuse the power of the office are held accountable. I think we have the most rigorous and, in fact, the most punitive system of punishment for police than we do for any other city employee of any brand. And so I think there's no shortage of capacity to do that. This feedback was helpful today. When I look at this process, I would remind us what you have is first a complete and thorough internal affairs investigation, which means every single case is never shortened to the length or depth of the investigation based on the severity of the charge. After that thorough investigation, then it goes to OIM to certify that that investigation was both thorough and complete, which means to certify that something that was named as discourtesy wasn't actually intimidation, or that someone that was blocking their badge wasn't doing it because they were holding a grocery bag, but because they were actually trying to prevent someone from ascertaining their identity to make a claim. After that is certified to be thorough and complete and that the charges are adequate and appropriate to what the behavior was, it would then go to a recommendation for education-based development, which would have then returned to the independent monitor again for review and recommendations on the specific decision for that thorough and complete investigation to be aligned to education-based development. So to me, that's three separate, very thorough checks on a process. And then we'll have the data to know exactly which of those decisions were made to go to EBD, which were not, and what the outcomes from the officers that went into both of those patterns were. And so to me, that is both a thorough and complete process for feedback, as well as a thorough and complete set of checks to make sure the concerns raised today do not happen. But I will defer to the Chief on any other comments he wants to make on what the process
is. Just a couple of short comments. I mean, first, I've understood that I've had the capacity to institute policy as I see fit, but I chose specifically for this policy to engage community, to have a lot of input on this. And so I think next steps are continuing to meet with the Office of the Independent Monitor to try to remove or eliminate that daylight that is still between us, and continue to listen to feedback. And so, overwhelming amount of feedback on the policy that we have posted on our website. And so we continue to monitor that and take advantage of that opportunity to understand what the community desire is.
Thank you, Chief, for being here. Thanks for all the members of the public for being here. Thank you, Council. We are adjourned. Have a great Tuesday.
She does not sleep in a bag. She sleeps sitting up. She is 108.
You stay to sleep at night, you don't rest. It never leaves your mind. No. We weren't allowed to talk about it. And my sister just mentioned it about 2-3 years ago.
It was traumatic for me. How is it that you've been, things you've done, suppressed?
I again thank our witnesses for being with us this morning. We really do look forward to your testimony, and I'll tell you, we don't have many centenarians testify before our committees.
Sadly, many Americans today are not even aware that this massacre took place. And I hope that this hearing can serve to educate the public about what